Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. March is Women's History Month, and in recognition of that annual celebration, we'll be talking to historian Donna Gabacha about American immigration history from the woman's perspective. But before we do that, let's look back at an important event that occurred this week in history. On March 10, 1876, the following words changed the way we communicate. "Mr. Watson, come here. I want to see you." This sentence, uttered by Alexander Graham Bell to his assistant Thomas Watson, became the first words ever transmitted through a telephone line. As much accident as an attempted phone call, Bell did not intend his words to be heard via his telephone line, Bell's experimental variable resistance machine, as it was called, set in motion a communications revolution that quickly brought the world closer together. Turning to items of interest in the news, a recently discovered note from a former mayor of Chicago has positively confirmed one of the enduring legends regarding the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. Upon learning that the flames were quickly closing in on the city jail, then-Mayor Roswell Mason scribbled an order on a piece of police stationery to, quote, "release all prisoners from jail at once, keeping them in custody if possible." Some of those prisoners, it was later reported, disappeared. The note, stashed in a family scrapbook for years, was recently donated by a great-great-granddaughter of the mayor to the Chicago Historical Society. And the famed discoverer of the Titanic, Robert Ballard, is now setting his sights on another big prize, relics from the biblical flood that Noah and his family survived. While Noah's Ark is not the subject of the search, Ballard hopes to find pieces of an ancient civilization wiped out 7,000 years ago. He and other researchers speculate that the floods described in the Bible correspond with a time of melting glaciers and rising sea levels around the Black Sea at the end of the last ice age. You're listening to Talking History. Immigration history is central to our understanding of the American past, and central to immigration history is the story of the immigrant woman's experience. Here to explore the subject is Creighton historian Dennis Mihalik, who will be talking to our special guest for today's show, Donna Gabacha. Dennis?
Thank you, Brian. It is common knowledge that the United States is a nation of immigrants. As we are currently celebrating Women's History Month, today's program will look at immigration from a female perspective. That insight will be provided by today's guest, Dr. Donna Gabacha, who is the Charles H. Stone Professor of American History at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Dr. Gabacha is the author of several books, including We Are What We Eat, Ethnic Food and the Making of Americans, available from the Harvard University Press. Also, a book titled From the Other Side, Women, Gender, and Immigrant Life in the United States, available from the Indiana University Press. Welcome, Dr. Gabacha.
Hi, Dennis.
Let's begin with the obvious question. Was the immigrant experience different for women?
Well, it almost seems obvious to say that yes, in fact, it was. Most study of immigration into the United States has focused on the process by which immigrants become Americans. And of course, when we talk about Americans, we really mean American men or American women. And for women immigrants, the challenge was not to become a genderless American generally, but rather to become something very specific, which was an American woman. And as American notions of what a proper woman should be have changed, to the target to which immigrant women have been accustoming and adapting themselves has changed as well. And so the process of becoming an American woman has really changed significantly over time as the lives of American women have changed.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of that experience, most likely it was affected by a person's race, by their age. Is that true?
Oh, absolutely. I think the really significant difference for immigrant women arriving in the United States has to do with what time they arrived in the United States, whether they came at a time when America defined women as responsible primarily for the domestic sphere and domestic work, or whether they entered the United States more recently when it's widely accepted now that women will also work for wages. It's been very heavily influenced by the racial and the ethnic background of immigrant women. Some jobs were simply not open to immigrant women generally because of their language or because of their culture, but also because of their race. And in the case of Asian women in particular, sometimes the door to the United States was simply closed, as it was also for men. One very important difference that shaped immigrant women's experiences in the United States was whether they were young and unmarried, or even teenagers or children when they came to the United States, or whether they were grown women. Grown women who were already married at the time they entered the United States often faced particularly challenging cultural problems because on the one hand, they were responsible for helping their children adapt to the United States, whereas at the same time, as teachers and rearers of younger children, they often felt tugged by the homeland culture, whether or not, for example, to teach their children the language of their native lands, or whether to teach them only or encourage them to learn English. So as mothers, immigrant women often felt torn in two directions. By contrast, girls who came here young often learned English more quickly. They often found that a wider range of jobs were available to them. The tug of the homeland was often much lower on them, and they often saw America as a place for female emancipation where they could escape from some of the cultural conventions that they saw as limiting their own mothers' lives and experiences.
Mm-hmm. When we think of immigrants, many times we think of single men on the move. I mean, were there lots of young single women that migrated to the United States?
Well, that varies a lot from group to group. And, of course, in the 19th century, the typical immigrant was a man on the move. But even in the 19th century, there were some groups, like the Irish, for example, where women outnumbered men, and many of them were, in fact, young and single women. They were looking either for better work opportunities or better opportunities to marry than they might have had in their homeland. Today, women are almost equal in number to men, and significant numbers of them, in fact, arrive in the United States on their own. Women from the Caribbean frequently lead the way in chain migrations from their villages and from their families. They establish a kind of outpost. They're the first to take the job, and leaving sometimes even children behind with grandparents and other relatives. So whereas the majority of women in the past moved as part of family groups, there were always independent women, and their numbers have actually increased with the more recent, more gender-balanced migrations that we've seen in the United States since World War II.
Mm-hmm. Now, you introduced a concept that is very familiar to those of us who teach immigration history. That's the idea of chain migration.
Yes.
Could you explain that for our listeners, please?
Oh, a chain migration. Yes, that's a real technical term for those of us who teach immigration, isn't it? Chain migration simply refers to the fact that the decision to migrate and the choice of a location is usually determined by a friend or a relative who's preceded you. It's a nice metaphor. It suggests that people are linked together, like links in a chain, from one location in the homeland to very specific destinations in the United States. And it refers to the fact that past and present, men and women, immigrants have tended to follow in the footsteps of friends and family members who've gone before them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you also mentioned this relationship between mother and daughter. And many immigration historians or anthropologists have set up this generational scheme in terms of migration to the United States, where the immigrant comes and remains an immigrant, a person from the old world, and in the second generation rebels and becomes the American, and in the third generation feels the loss of their immigrant roots and wants to get them back. Does that scenario fit women?
Well, I think it fits women a little bit less well than it fits men. I think in general, the scenario you've described is an accurate one for the majority of men and for the majority of women. But there are certain things about the female experience that make that generational change perhaps a little bit less pronounced than it may be in the case of men. And again, the reason for that, I think, has to do with women's responsibility for raising and really teaching children. And we know from sociological and psychological studies that women tend to rear their children as their mothers reared them. And that creates a sense, I think, of more cultural continuity for women across the generations. And that's particularly true, I think, because it's in the United States we know that ethnicity itself is something that can be rejected or accepted, but it becomes a dimension of family life. Even after the language is forgotten, there are food customs, there are family religious and holiday traditions that have to be or that are maintained as a kind of marker of a family's distinctiveness. And very often it's the work of the women that guarantee that those family holidays and those family traditions continue. And that creates at least a temptation, even for the second generation girl who wants to be thought of as completely American, to nevertheless continue in some ways to follow in the footstep of her mother, who she often admits she has admired as a kind of a role model, and to find satisfaction in continuing to deliver at least some markers of an ethnic identity. And the sociological evidence does show, in fact, that women are more likely to have an ethnic identity and to claim that it's important to them than men are in the United States today.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, when you say an ethnic identity, and then, of course, this cultural transformation, I mean, assimilation, that is, Americanizing or becoming American, is so key to this immigration experience.
Mm-hmm.
Did women Americanize in the same way that men did?
Well, I think my favorite examples that I use in answering a question like this actually come from my research on food, because in many ways, women as cooks of culinary traditions that may have, you know, are new to the United States when they first arrive as immigrants, actually become part of the mainstream. And it's incorrect in some ways to talk only about Americanization, since when we look at certain kinds of habits, and food is really the best example, the continuation of older traditions from the homeland really eventually changes the way Americans of all backgrounds eat. And there's a kind of adjustment that occurs here, especially in the culinary realm, of America to the immigrants, as well as immigrants to America. I wouldn't want to claim that immigrants and their children and grandchildren don't become more like Americans over the course of several generations, because, of course, in fact, they do. But especially when we look at women as cooks, we see that as cooks, as participants in family businesses, selling specialties often of their family backgrounds, as participants in ethnic societies that often use food as a way of demonstrating their ethnicity to people of other backgrounds at food fairs and ethnic fairs and the like. By the way, they've been going on since the 1920s in the United States. Women have also influenced what we think of as American food, and it is now a kind of a smorgasbord of the ethnic traditions of many people, rather than, say, the food of the first Americans, the corn and squash of Native Americans, or the foods of the Puritans and descendants of the English, who in many other respects, linguistically and politically, define what American is. When it comes to food, really immigrants have made America what it is, rather than the other way around, and that would not have happened without the culinary skills, obviously, of several generations of immigrant women to the United States.
Mm-hmm. In your book, We Are What We Eat, Ethnic Food and the Making of Americans, you describe a 50-year food fight, as you entitled it, and that fight was between women. Could you explain this female culture clash to our audience?
Yes, I use the word food fight with the modification that in terms of the, you know, comparison to the other kinds of ethnic and racial struggles that we have seen in the United States, this is really a very short and very mild conflict. But you are certainly right. It is a conflict between women. At the time of the largest migration into the United States in the 1880s and the 1890s, there was concern among American, native-born American women, many of them of English descent, many of them living in the large cities of the Northeast, that the new immigrants didn't know how to eat like Americans. And there's a real effort at the turn of the century by home economists, in particular, to define a kind of American cuisine that was linked to the traditions of New England, and to try to teach that cuisine, not just to the new immigrant women, but to poorer women, African-American women in the South, rural women in the West, Hispanic women in the Southwest, and to teach it to them as a way of learning what American domesticity required of them, and to teach it to them as a form of scientific and rational eating. The food, the home economists, however, really lose that battle. And if anything, immigrant women and the other women whom they tried to influence really stuck to their own foods, and not only continued to feed their families as they saw fit and as creatively as they saw fit, but they also eventually changed the minds of the home economists. And by the 1920s and 30s and 40s, by the end of this 50-year food fight, you could open a home economics book, or you could look at a pamphlet of a menu tips for families on welfare in New York City, and you would have found the home economist not recommending the codfish cakes and cornmeal of their Puritan ancestors in New England, but rather recommending to Puerto Ricans recently arrived in New York City, for example, that they try spaghetti as a low-cost alternative. So if anyone really won the food fight, I would argue it was the recent immigrants, rather than the native-born women and their effort to create an American cuisine that was defined by an English past.
Mm-hmm. Now, in talking about these recent immigrants, immigration historians talk about three waves of immigrants, and the last wave has been since the immigration laws were changed in 1965. Female migrants now in the 70s, 80s, and contemporary in the 90s, is their experience similar and or different to previous women migrants?
Well, scholars really differ on this issue, and so I'm going to give you what my opinion is, letting you know that there are other scholars out there who might disagree with me on this particular point. It seems to me that in most ways, immigrant women entering the United States today are particularly well prepared to make a relatively painless and easy adjustment. And that's true despite the fact that many of them come from what we think of as the third world. They no longer come from Europe. They come from Asia. They come from Latin America. They come from the Caribbean. Many of them are of African descent. In other words, they are non-white in the traditional America racial scheme of things. And for that reason, I think at least some scholars anticipate that their adjustment is going to be particularly difficult. I would argue, on the other hand, however, that a number of things suggest that, in fact, women's adjustment now is in some ways easier and less problematic than it was 100 years ago. One reason is first of all, they now enter a country where it is widely accepted that women will work, and large numbers of native-born American women are working, whereas in the past, immigrant women were far more likely to work and to be disparaged for working and for abandoning their domestic responsibilities than is the case today. The other thing that I think may make the adjustment of immigrant women in the United States perhaps a trifle easier than for those in the past is they enter a country that is now committed to eliminating from public life forms of racial and ethnic and religious discrimination that were routinely accepted in the years around the 20th century, not just in the job market, but in what we would think of as welfare services today. And finally, one of the reasons that I think immigrant women today should make a relatively smooth adjustment when compared to those of the 19th century is that a very substantial proportion of immigrant women entering the United States today bring a lot of what's called human capital with them. They are from relatively prosperous backgrounds. They are just as likely to have a college degree as women born in this country. They are even more likely than American women to work in a number of very prestigious and male-dominated professions in the sciences and in technological fields, for example. They bring with them, in other words, an ability to speak English, to perform in the economy at a much higher level than was the case of immigrant women in the past. And middle-class status generally has been associated historically with a relatively easy transition to American life, and about a quarter to a third of immigrant women entering the United States today, we can reasonably say, are of middle-class background, well-educated, and well-prepared to contribute professionally rather than at the lower ends of the job market, as was almost universally the case 100 years ago. So they bring a lot more human capital with them, a lot more skills than was true of the immigrant women of the past, and they're entering a country that is committed to allowing people, irregardless of race or religion or ethnic background, to make the contributions of which they're capable. Now, that's a very rosy view, and I said some.
Well, but those are very interesting points, very interesting observations of the differences between the past and now. And I'm sorry to interrupt, but that
that's
is
okay.
All the time that we have. I'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Donna Gabacha of the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, for this very interesting interview.
Thank you.
This being the final year of the century, as well as the millennium, we'll be taking time upon occasion to reflect upon some of the more momentous events and important people of the past 100 and 1,000 years. We'll also pause to consider some of the lessons learned from the history of both periods. Today we take up the subject of suffering civilians from the many wars that plagued the world during the 20th century. Here to comment on that subject for our op-ed of the week is Stephen Rosenfeld. Rosenfeld is the deputy editorial page editor for The Washington Post. He has titled his op-ed, Century Was Unkind to Suffering Civilians.
This is what flashed into my mind the other day when Iraqis alleged that 11 civilians were killed in a U.S. missile attack near Basra. Americans confirmed that a video-guided missile fired at Iraqi air defenses had gone astray. The missile was one of the hot new AGM-130s designed to allow U.S. warplanes to deliver a ton of explosives greater distances and with greater precision than earlier missiles. But I doubt still the improvements can anticipate and separate out all the different kinds of accidents that are possible in the strategic alphabet. It troubles me. The reigning image of contemporary warfare borrows heavily from the Gulf War photos of missiles disappearing down air vents. But the irreducible reality remains the prospect of misfires on account of the frailties of designers and operators alike. The days of machines fighting machines, practically without human contacts or casualties, are still a long way off. When the wrong targets get hit, people worry that the other guys, here the Iraqis, will be given a propaganda windfall. A countering effort is made to shift the onus for such casualties to the Iraqis for sprinkling military targets in civilian zones. This may be a valid political exercise, but there can be no comfort for Americans in waging or even winning this sort of propaganda war. The actual victims of the shooting cannot be brought back. Dual-usage targets sharpen the dilemma. For instance, when, as in the Gulf War, we hit the electric power station serving not only military usages but also civilian usages, such as water and sanitation facilities. That the resulting civilian casualties were and continue to be extravagantly high cannot be dismissed as simply the product of the cynicism of Saddam Hussein. It was American bombs and missiles that took the toll. In such difficult circumstances, a certain calculus must be done, weighing the costs of permitting Saddam Hussein to stay in power unperturbed against the costs of doing what is necessary to hasten his departure. It is a contest between the damage he has done and yet may do, and the damage that we and others may do in attempting to contain or remove him. Not just a sense of urgency, but a sense of proportion which must govern such calculations. There must be a readiness to address the question of our own responsibility in a way that produces neither rampant license nor stifling paralysis. The Geneva Codes are meant to protect, among others, innocent civilian populations, but a glance around the world reveals instance after instance where civilians are at massive risk, where they are in fact singled out as targets because they occupy land or property that others covet, or because they provide the network of sanctuary and support that allows soldiers to move to battle. Our fading century has surely seen more fearful innocents dead or on the move from danger than any other. And the century is not over.
You've been listening to Stephen Rosenfeld, Deputy Editorial Page Editor for The Washington Post. And this is Talking History. There are no more prominent symbols of American immigration than the Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island, both of which are located in New York Harbor. We've therefore chosen for our historic site of the week the Ellis Island Immigration Museum. And here to tell you more about the museum is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Located just north of the Statue of Liberty in the New York Harbor, the Ellis Island Immigration Museum is a monument to the great traditions of freedom and opportunity in America. The museum offers a fascinating look at the total immigration experience using artifacts, photos, interactive devices, and tape stories from the immigrants themselves. You can see the historic Great Hall where millions once waited for medical and legal processing. Two theaters show the award-winning film Island of Hope, Island of Tears, and there are more than 30 separate galleries filled with artifacts, photos, and much more. There is also the Immigrant Wall of Honor, which contains the names of over 500,000 immigrants, including George Washington's great-grandfather and the great-grandparents of John F. Kennedy. The museum is open daily, except for Christmas, from 9:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. Call the National Park Service for more information.
Thank you, Cindy. And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions. First, the Margaret Mitchell House, yes, the author of Gone with the Wind, is currently offering an exhibit on the historic contributions of Irish-American women. Fire Upon the Hearth runs through March 31st at the Mitchell House, which is in Atlanta, Georgia. And Shaker Gifts, Shaker Genius, a collection of crafts that allows you to explore both the art and history of the American Shakers, will be on display until April 2nd at the Shaker Museum and Library in Old Chatham, New York. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show and that you'll join us next week for our special St. Patrick's Day show when we will explore the history behind the ongoing troubles in Northern Ireland. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
Oh, Father dear, I oftentimes hear you talk of Erin's Isle, her lofty scenes and valleys green, her mountains rude and wild. They say it is a pretty place where might dwell.